The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
You know, sometimes the experiences that impact us the most are the ones that we almost miss. When I finished the army, I was back in yeshiva, right, an institute of higher learning, and I had actually just begun my studies for the Israeli rabbinate. And one of the things that I looked forward to, we had the privilege of having not one, but two Roshei Yeshiva, two heads of the yeshiva. That's a story in and of itself. One of them was, and still is, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, who was the son-in-law of Yoshe Ber Soloveitchik, tremendous Torah scholar. And the other one was Rav Yehuda Amital. Rav Amital was someone that there are no words to describe just these two individuals. And we were in awe of them, okay? And one of the things that I look forward to was that once a week, you know, especially when you were one of the younger students and you weren't in the regular classes of the Rosh Yeshiva because they were at a much higher level, but once a week they would give a shiur, a class, to the whole yeshiva, okay, to the whole school. And guys would spend all Tuesday morning preparing for this class because it was very complicated. You had to be able to follow it. And then in the afternoon, sort of after the afternoon service, you know, the whole yeshiva would gather together in the Beit Midrash. When I was there, that was like 500-600 guys. And we would sort of just be on the edges of our chairs and listen to this class, right? Anyway, so this particular week, I was on my way up the stairs to the study hall, to the Beis Medrash, and I noticed a student whose face I didn't recognize. He was coming out of one of the telephone booths in the hall. Remember when they still needed telephone booths, right? He appeared to be very upset. He looked as though he'd been crying, you know, which you didn't normally see. I mean, these were 18, 19, 20-year-old guys. And I asked him if he was okay, and although he was upset, he nodded in the affirmative. I didn't want to intrude in his privacy, and the yeshiva was about to daven, you know, the afternoon service, and then we had the class. So I just continued up the stairs to my seat. I didn't know who this apparently new student was, but I couldn't get him off my mind. And after asking around, I found out that he was a new student who had just arrived from England, and seemed he was a bit homesick. And I didn't see him in the Beis Medrash, and I sort of resolved that I would later on during dinner, I would, you know, take a look around, see if I could find him, make sure he was okay, because he really looked upset. And I assumed he must have just called home, which would explain his state of mind when he walked out of the phone booth. Anyway, after Mincha, after the afternoon service, Rav Amital, the head of the yeshiva, was due to give this lecture, and especially as we'd been preparing for the lecture all morning, I didn't want to miss it. But I still couldn't get that student off my mind. And after the conclusion of the service, everybody found their seats, and there was like an air of anticipation as everybody sort of sat ready, waiting for Rav Amital to begin his class. And Rav Amital was nowhere to be found. He just wasn't there, but, you know, this happens sometimes. And I had actually seen Rav Amital during the afternoon service, but now he was nowhere to be seen. However, there was no announcement that there was any change in the schedule, so everybody was just sort of waiting in their seats for him to come back into the hall to begin his lecture. It's hard to explain, you know, the feeling of a student body of a yeshiva that they have towards their Rosh Yeshiva, right? It was something akin to awe. I mean, Rav Amital was a Holocaust survivor. He had also fought in the War of Independence. He was and still is, a Torah scholar of immense proportions. His students were my most revered teachers. So the thought of missing his lecture was anathema to me. But I could not get this student off my mind. And after a few minutes of waiting, I realized I probably wouldn't be able to concentrate on the lecture anyway. So I decided to take a risk and see if the boy was still downstairs or outside in the large courtyard. There was the entrance to Yeshivat HaRetzion is a beautiful courtyard with this incredible view of the Judean Hills, and it wasn't uncommon to see a student or two, you know, sort of hanging out there under thought. Anyway, when I stepped out into the courtyard, I actually did find the student, but he wasn't alone. And his eyes were no longer brimming over with tears. Rav Amital was talking to him, and the two of them were laughing. And much, much later, when I finally got to know the boy and was able to ask him what they'd been talking about without the risk of embarrassing him, it turned out that he had indeed been incredibly homesick and was considering leaving the yeshiva. And the thought of sitting through yet another lecture was just too much for him, and he decided to go for a walk and do some thinking. And Rav Amital, who had apparently gone to the yeshiva office for a moment to get something, was returning to deliver his lecture and noticed this student with the same long face. And with an entire yeshiva of hundreds of students waiting upstairs for his lecture, he stopped to chat with this boy and cheer him up. I mean, imagine, one of the greatest Torah scholars of this generation, who, by the way, later became a Knesset member and a minister in the government of Israel, was willing to keep 400 students waiting just to put a smile on the face of a new student that he didn't even know. Okay? I want you to know that up until that day, Rav Amital had been my Rosh Yeshiva. But in that moment, he became my Rebbe. Right? And I would have missed this entire experience, right? But that I happened to go downstairs. This week's portion to Tzaveh, okay, opens with a particular mitzvah, which seems at first glance to be very out of place. But as you will see, I think that this story, hidden within it, is the essence of what this week's portion is all about. And there's an idea in this week's portion that's so powerful and so critical and so easy to miss that we have to take a moment to take note of it. Okay? Hashem tells Moshe, God tells Moshe at the beginning of this week's portion. Now, by the way, we are in the middle now of a group of portions that really talk about the tabernacle. They talk about the Mishkan. Okay? They talk about what we're supposed to build and how we're supposed to build it and what we're going to put in the tabernacle, the tent of meeting that we're going to have in the desert and eventually in Israel when we get to Israel. And in the middle of all this, this week's portion begins, Ve'ata titzaveh et bnei Yisrael, right? And you shall command the children of Israel, v'yikhu elecha, and they will take to you shemen zayit zach, okay, pure olive oil, katit lama'or, which is a certain type of, it's the first drops, you know, that come out of the olives. Only the first drop of an olive can be used for the menorah in the temple, right? So you have to take this purest, best, richest oil, lama'or, for the lighting, l'ha'alot ner tamid, to offer up an eternal flame, be'ol mo'ed, in the tent of meeting, Michutz laparochet, outside of the curtain, asher alaidut, which is on the testimony. In other words, there's a curtain that divides the part of the tabernacle where the holy ark stood. Ya'aroch oto aron uvanav. That's where Aaron should set it up. And when it says it means the menorah, the lights of the menorah, because that's where it was. Me'erev ad boker, from evening until morning, which may mean morning and evening. Lifnei Hashem, before God, chukat olam l'dorot echem me'ed b'nei Yisrael. And this is a law forever for the Jewish people. That's what the commandment says. I want you, says God to Moshe, to command the Jewish people to bring you, to take to you, you know, pure olive oil, right? To offer up an eternal flame in the tent of meeting, right? Just opposite the ark. That's where Aaron and his sons, the Kohanim, will, from evening until morning, light the menorah. That's what the mitzvah is. Okay? Now, there are a few strange things about this particular mitzvah, right? And as is or has become our custom, I'm going to share with you a few questions, and, you know, we'll sort of see what we do with it. Okay? First of all, it's interesting that if you ask the average person what this mitzvah is about the menorah. It's about lighting the menorah in the temple. Okay? Now, put aside for the moment why we need a menorah in the temple, and let's at least agree that the menorah in the temple is not because God needs light in his apartment. Right? Because God doesn't need light. We do. So whatever the menorah is about, we're lighting this menorah because we need this menorah. Okay. And yet, it's interesting, there's no mention of the menorah. This whole mitzvah is about Aaron and his sons setting up the wicks for the flame that will be sitting in the menorah. But it doesn't mention the menorah. There's no mention of the menorah. It's all about the wicks. In fact, Maimonides, like aside from, if you look in the verse, it says, Ya'aroch oto Aaron uvanav, right? That Aaron and his sons will arrange it, will set it up. You know, it's like we're used to candles that you buy in the store and just stick them in the menorah. But if you look at sort of the more traditional menorahs, so you have to put your oil. This is what I use. There's actually a tradition on Hanukkah, if you can, to use olive oil. You know, it's a beautification of the mitzvah because that's what happened on Hanukkah. So it's a pain. You got to take your olive oil, you got to pour it into the glass, you got to put a wick in, make sure it's just right, make sure it'll float. You know, even today where they come up with these magical, like, you know, little glass things in Israel that already have the oil in them and the wick and the whole deal, it's still a schmutz, right? So there's no mention of the menorah, and the Rambam, Maimonides, who has a magnificent book called the Sefer HaMitzvot, he was one of the first, but not the first, to set the Torah up in terms of a book of all the mitzvot. It's called the Book of Mitzvot, the Book of Commandments, and you can study the Rambam and study all the different mitzvot. So the Rambam, right, and by the way, Maimonides divides these mitzvot into positive and negative. In other words, there are mitzvot that are commandments as to what you're supposed to do, you know, like you're supposed to love your fellow human being, you're supposed to respect your parents, you're supposed to wear tzitzit, whatever that might be, right, to fill in. And then there are mitzvot of what not to do. Don't steal, don't adulter, right? The 25th positive commandment is actually defined by Maimonides as la'aroch nerot b'mikdash, to set up wicks in the temple. Now that's very strange. It doesn't say that the mitzvah is to light the candles. It says the mitzvah is to set up the wick. Why is it all about the wicks? And by the way, if you look in the Rambam's magnum opus, Maimonides' magnum opus, what's called the Yad HaChazakah, his book of law. So in the laws of Tmidin, which are the sacrifices and those things that are eternal in the temple, so he lists very clearly in chapter 3 there as one mitzvah, the setting up and the lighting of the candles. Right? The setting up and the lighting of the candles is basically the same mitzvah. Now why is there no separation between the preparation for the mitzvah and the mitzvah itself? Okay? You know, for example, by matzah, when you bake matzah, right? So the mitzvah is to eat matzah on the night of Passover. But before you get to eat matzah on the night of Passover, you have to bake matzah. So there's actually a special idea that you bake matzah. Some people bake matzah on the eve of Passover. But that's not the mitzvah. The mitzvah is to eat the matzah. And there's usually a separation between the preparation for the mitzvah and the mitzvah. Why here is the preparation for the mitzvah part of the mitzvah itself? Okay? Give you another question. The verses here say that we're supposed to offer up an eternal flame, a ner tamid. Tamid means always, constant. In fact, we today in our synagogues have a ner tamid. We have an eternal flame, and that's supposed to, that's a very strong custom. It dates back to the time of the temple. And generally, most rabbis believe that this custom was set up so that we would never forget the temple. So you could make a case for saying that this mitzvah actually resembles what it must have been like in the temple. And if that's so, we don't turn the eternal flame off at night. You know, I mean, I don't know if you've ever been in a synagogue after hours. That eternal flame by the ark is still flying. Because that's what the word tamid means. So that must mean that these candles are supposed to be tamid, always. They're supposed to be constantly lit. And yet if you look in the verse says very clearly, me'erev ad boker, from evening until morning. Right? You lit them in the evening, they lasted until the morning, then at some point in the day, you cleaned out the receptacles and prepared the new wicks, and you lit them again in the evening. So then why is it called ner tamid? Why is it always? It's also interesting that it calls it lama'or, right? You're going to take this oil, this special oil, lama'or. Lama'or literally means the light, okay? Or the lamp, which holds the light. Why doesn't it say la'ir, which means to light as a verb? You know, I light candles, la'ir, to light up my house. So why is it talking about the candle, the light, as the focus of this mitzvah, instead of, you know, sort of the light as the vehicle for you know, sort of lighting up the world, right? And by the way, another interesting question is why this appears here. Why is this in this week's portion? This is not the portion where we talk about the menorah. Okay, the actual dedication of the menorah and the mitzvah of the menorah is discussed in the book of Leviticus. And last week, it talks about in the parasha the building of the actual menorah. So why is the mitzvah of the oil for the lighting of the menorah in this week's portion? Especially since we don't mention the menorah in this week's portion. Right? And there's another interesting thing which is worth noticing, which is that if the portion begins with a special mitzvah, where the focus seems more on the process that prepares us for the mitzvah, namely setting up the wicks, as opposed to the mitzvah itself, the light of the menorah, if you look at the end of this week's portion, there is another mitzvah, and there too, it seems to be more about the vehicle, the preparation, than the mitzvah itself. The last mitzvah in the end of this week's portion, ve'asita mizbeach, you're supposed to make an altar, okay, miktar toret, where you can offer up the incense. And if you look at the end of the portion in chapter 30, that whole discussion there is how you build a mizbeach, and what its measurements are, and that you have to cover it with gold, and that you have to have poles alongside it, and all these different halachot.
so that one day Aaron can offer up the incense. But the mitzvah to offer up incense does not appear here. The mitzvah here is to create the altar on which the incense can be offered. Right? And then it speaks about what you do, that you don't offer up a strange incense, you only offer up this incense. So that's very interesting. First of all, what's the connection between the mitzvah of incense and the mitzvah of the menorah? Right? And second of all, why are these two mitzvot, the framing of this portion, the beginning and end of the portion of Tetzaveh, and why in both of these cases are the mitzvah, does the Torah seem to speak more about the process of preparing for the mitzvah than the mitzvah itself? Right? And by the way, it's interesting that Ketoret, if you look in that, at the end of the portion, almost at the end of the portion in verse 8, right, it actually says, Ketoret tamid lifnei Hashem v'garatechem. This incense is also supposed to be tamid. And that's even stranger. Because if tamid means always, incense was not offered up always. Incense was offered up daily, and then a very special incense was offered on Yom Kippur. But it wasn't constant. So what's the connection between these two mitzvot? Right? And maybe just a last couple things in terms of the specifics of the beginning of the portion. You know, first of all, it says that God says, V'ata titzaveh, and you will command. And God says to Moshe, and you shall command. That's very strange language. Because normally God says, it just says God says to Moshe. V'idebre Hashem el Moshe lemor, and God spoke to Moshe saying. And the word lemor, or saying, usually means that God spoke to Moshe in order that Moshe be able to repeat it to the Jewish people. But here, God tells Moshe to command. Why is Moshe giving this mitzvah? If already it's going to be a commandment, which is strange anyway, instead of just being told over, then why doesn't the commandment come from God? And of course, if a commandment comes from God, you almost don't need the commandment, because how could you say no to God? Right? It's also interesting that they bring the oil to Moshe, v'yikhu elecha shemen zaitzach, and command the Jewish people to bring to you this pure oil. Why are you bringing the oil to Moshe? Bring it to the temple, bring it to God. And lastly, fascinating. There is something about this week's portion that makes it unique in the entire Torah. And that is that since the birth of Moshe in the portion of Exodus and Shemot, the only portion in the entire Torah from the time of the birth of Moshe where Moshe's name is not mentioned is this week's portion. In this week's portion, you do not find the name Moshe. Now, that's very interesting, right? In fact, the Medrash, the rabbis, have an interesting discussion. The Medrash suggests, rabbinic tradition suggests, that in the sin of the golden calf, in Perek Lamed Bet, in chapter 32, in verse 33, which is in next week's portion, Moshe says to God, Mecheni na misifrecha, okay, erase me from your book. In other words, if I can't achieve forgiveness for the Jewish people for the sin of the golden calf, then I don't want to be in the Torah. And despite the fact that Hashem does indeed forgive us, right, and consequently Moshe's plea was accepted, nonetheless, part of Moshe's declaration comes to pass. Because if a tzaddik like Moshe says something, then some of it has to come to pass. And therefore, in this week's portion, Moshe's name is indeed not mentioned. It's as it were erased from the Torah. Of course, this leaves us wondering why that has to occur in this week's portion. And what Moshe was really suggesting in the first place. What does that mean? Erase me from your book. Right? And even more intriguing, and this is, I'll mention this as an aside, but what you do with this is up to you. You know, the Kabbalists, I mean, the Pre-Tzaddik talks about this, or Tzaddik HaKohen, explain that Moshe's soul was actually the reincarnation of Noah, of Noah as in Noah and the flood. Now, what you do with that sort of a sentence, well, that's up to you. If you want to know if I completely understand what that is, nope, right? Haven't figured that out yet. But as an idea, somehow, you know, they're connected. And what's interesting is that the word Mecheni, right? Moshe says, erase me from your book. Mecheni, right? Are the same letters as the phrase Mei Noach, the floodwaters of Noach. And in fact, the book of Chronicles refers to the flood as Mei Noach, the floodwaters of Noah, implying that on some level, the tragedy of the flood was Noach's responsibility. Because unlike Abraham's attempt to save Sodom, Noach seems to have made no effort to save the world and avert the destruction of the flood. Moshe, however, averts the tragedy of the destruction of the Jewish people, literally putting his own name on the line, rather than, as it were, allow God to destroy his people. On a mystical level, then, Moshe does what we call tikkun, to fix. Moshe fixes the mistake that came into the world in the time of Noah. If in the time of Noah there was an inability, an insensitivity for the whole of humanity, which resulted in a tzaddik not struggling enough, perhaps, again, we can't judge Noah, but at least that's the sense that you get, to see that the world wasn't destroyed, Moshe brings back a level of sensitivity that's so huge, right, that he can save the entire Jewish people. And on a mystical level, maybe even the world. Okay? Moshe fixes the error that came into the world in the time of Noah and achieves tikkun for Noah's soul. So what does all this have to do with our portion and the mitzvah of the menorah? So now we're going to get deep. This is an unbelievable idea. Okay? The Lubavitcher Rebbe, in his Likutei Sichot, whatever his comments on the portion, says that it's true that Moshe is not mentioned in this portion. And yet, Moshe is very clearly mentioned in this portion, even though he's not mentioned by name. Because the entire portion begins with the word, Ve'ata, and you. Ve'ata tetzaveh, and you shall command the Jewish people concerning the oil. And the Ve'ata, the words and you, which begin this entire portion, very clearly refers to Moshe. In fact, if you think about it, it refers to Moshe on a much higher level than his name. Because a name, although certainly very connected, you know, on a very deep level to who a person really is, nonetheless merely designates a person for everyone else. Right? The person themselves doesn't actually need their own name because they're in touch with themselves on a much deeper level. You know, you may think of me as Binny, but I don't think of myself as Binny. I think of myself as me. And that's much more than Binny. You know? I may know you as David or Stephen, or Leslie, or whoever, right? But you don't think of yourself as Stephen, because you don't call yourself Stephen. Stephen is just the phrase that allows everybody else to connect to you and to designate you as opposed to everybody else. But you don't need to designate yourself as opposed to everybody else, because you are totally wrapped up in you, right? Ve'ata, then, and you, the beginning of this week's portion, refers to the essence of who Moshe really is, which is beyond his name. Right? Before we're named, we've already come into the world. And we certainly exist. Right? When a child is born and doesn't have a name yet, you can't designate them to everyone else, but their existence is beyond their name. Right? More than, and the word ve'ata then refers to the essence of who we really are. So this portion, while being the only portion that doesn't mention Moshe's name since his birth, is actually the portion that most connects to the deepest essence of who Moshe is, because it doesn't even have to designate it. Now this is interesting, because Moshe's greatest attribute was his ability to recognize that he was really only a vessel for something much greater than himself. The Torah describes Moses at the end of his life as the greatest anav, the most humble person that ever lived. More than anything else, Moshe was able to get out of his own way. Okay? And that's very interesting. You know, people think that anava, that humility, is saying, you know, not me and trying to think that you're nothing. We've described before that anava, humility, is not about thinking you're nothing. Anava, humility, is about knowing that you're great, but recognizing it has nothing to do with you. You've just been given gifts. You're a vehicle for something greater. So interesting, how often do we get so wrapped up in ourselves and so caught up in making sure that we get what we want and what we need, that we forget that it isn't and never was supposed to be about us. We're just a vessel for something much greater, for the entire world. And this is the katit, the crushing, or really the pressing of the olive to release the pure olive oil within. Why is it that you only take the first drop, right? Which comes from the squeezing or the pressing of the oil, right? Because the purest part of yourself comes when you can squeeze your ego out of the way. You know, there's a beautiful prayer that we say three times a day. At the end of the Shemoneh Esrei, the silent Amidah prayer, we say, V'nafshi ke'afar lakol tiyeh. Let my soul, my life, be as earth to everybody else. You know? I don't need them to think of me as something. Can I be the earth that others walk on? Can I get in touch with the reality that I am meant to be a vehicle? And that all I ever want to be is a vehicle for light. This is being a vehicle for God. This is being able to see ourselves merely as a wick for the flame. Moshe was so in touch with the reality of the fact that he was a vessel and what he was a vessel for, that he was able to demonstrate that without the Jewish people, there was no longer a point to his existence. Right? The whole reason Moshe was in this world was to be a vehicle for teaching Torah to the Jewish people. If there was no Jewish people, there was no point to Moshe. That's amazing. In a time when rulers and monarchs were acting as gods and assuming that the people existed to serve them, Moshe was teaching the world that it's not the people who serve the leader. It's the leader who's meant to be a vessel to serve the people and indeed the world. And the word ve'ata and you, which is the beginning of the portion then, refers to a person's soul which is beyond his name. A soul has and indeed needs no name. If a name describes a person, the soul is really beyond description. And most of all, getting in touch with your soul is about connecting with why you are really here in this world. Moshe understood his purpose, and he understood that he was meant to be the instrument for bringing the Torah down to earth and giving it to the Jewish people. And thus, without the Jewish people, Moshe has no purpose. And maybe just a couple more points before we end. Because that's what this week's portion, and particularly this mitzvah, is all about. The mitzvah of the oil for the flame, for the menorah, is about connecting to real purpose. And it's about valuing the vehicle for achieving that purpose. Just like Moshe, the menorah was only the vehicle for bringing light into the world. It's interesting, so often we are so dazzled by the menorahs in this world that we forget that they only have value if they're vehicles for light. Which is why the menorah itself isn't even mentioned this week. So we can focus a little bit on the light. Our mission as a people in the end is simply to bring light into the world. And, indeed, if both the light of the menorah as well as the fragrance of the incense on the altar represent objects that are here but are not completely tangible, right? You can see light, but you can't really touch it or hold it. It transcends the physical on a certain level. And thus it and what it represents can never really be destroyed. And you can smell the incense, but you can't quite capture it. Much like the essence of who we are and the light each of us is meant to bring into the world, which we can connect to, but we can't really control. We can't capture it. And when you light the menorah and you bring flame into the world, you are achieving the essence of what the Mishkan is all about, of what the tabernacle is all about, which is to bring God's presence in the world. And of course, the tabernacle is just a paradigm and an allegory for life. Just as the soul, which is beyond the name, needs the body to have an impact here on earth, we need the menorah and the wicks to light up the world. Right? That's the essence of the purpose of having a temple. V'asuli mikdash, we said in last week's portion, let them make for me a temple, v'shachanti b'tocham, and I will dwell amongst them. It doesn't say I will dwell in it, in the temple. It says the temple will be a vehicle for bringing God into the world so that the world can sense God living amongst them. The purpose of the entire temple was to create a space for Hashem in our lives. And that's true, you know, for ourselves as well. And that's why a human being is termed a Mikdash Ma'at, a small sanctuary. And this mitzvah, right, the challenge of becoming a vehicle, each and every one of us, for bringing light into this world, this mitzvah is tamid. This mitzvah is eternal. Because long after the temple is destroyed and we lose the menorah, we will still have the light it was meant to give us. The challenge is to remember the purpose of it all, the light itself, and not lose focus amidst the dazzle of the menorah, right? And of course, you know, the problem with this is that bringing true light into the world and being a vehicle for disseminating such light is hard work. And as with all things in this world, it has its ups and downs. You know, to assume that a person can maintain this level and be a constant light is not of this world, and such an elevated goal is almost doomed to failure. This tamid, this eternalness, has its moments of morning and light, clarity, but it also has its points of evening and darkness, when things seem so challenging and the light seems so far away. And that's why it says, May Erev Ad Boker, right, from the evening until the morning. Even when it's Erev, even when it's evening, when it seems so dark, you have to remember that morning always comes. Maybe it's this attitude, this desire to even be a vehicle for light in the darkest of moments that is the true fulfillment of the concept of Tamir, of making it eternal. Because even in the midst of life's struggles, right, as long as we strive to achieve light,
then in truth the light which is deep inside of ourselves is always there. Okay? And I think that maybe for me, you know, that's why that moment with the Rav Amital is so powerful. Because a real Rosh Hashiva is meant to be a living Torah scroll. Not just when he's lecturing the entire yeshiva, but just as much when he's walking through the courtyard. You know, maybe one last thing, it's worth noting that the role, you know, the role of Aaron in this mitzvah, Aaron was the brother of Moshe, and he was destined to become the high priest. Okay? And one of his special mitzvot, you know, he had the role of actually kindling the lights on the menorah in the temple. Yet this mitzvah is given to Aaron and his sons before they are actually invested with the mantle of priesthood. Very interesting. Apparently the mitzvah of lighting the menorah was given to Aaron irrespective of his position as a kohen, as a priest. Because in the end, the priesthood was Aaron's role. But the lighting of the menorah reflected who Aaron really was and what he was all about. In fact, it explains why it's Aaron fulfilling this mitzvah and not Moshe. Right? Why wasn't it Moshe's job to light the menorah, especially since it was Moshe who brought Torah into the world, and the light, the menorah, represents Torah in the temple? So in fact, Moshe was meant to bring Torah to the earth, but it was Aaron's mission to spread it to the world. And the reason Aaron was such an appropriate vehicle for doing this was because the attribute that epitomized Aaron the most was shalom, was peace. Aaron in the Talmud, in the Ethics of the Fathers, is called the Ohev Shalom, the Rodev Shalom, the lover of peace, the pursuer of peace, right? And there's an interesting connection between this mitzvah and the concept of shalom, because interestingly enough, and we don't really have time to get into this, but the mitzvah of lighting Shabbat candles, according to the Talmud, stems from the idea of creating shalom bayit, of creating peace in the home, right? Because a person stumbling in the darkness is not really at peace, okay? And the word shalom also relates to the word shalem, to be whole, because it's my ability to see and be at one with everyone, which is what peace is all about. You know, Shabbat begins with the lighting of candles, because Shabbat is meant to remind us that this world is really all about bringing light into the world. And if the mikdash, if the temple is a sanctuary in space, Shabbat is a sanctuary in time, whose essence is also light. You know? And the challenge for each of us is to find the atah within, to find that part of ourselves, the essence of who we really are, the ultimate reason for why we're really here, and to bring that out into the world. And maybe that's the reason that this particular mitzvah is a tzivui, it's a command. In fact, the Medrash Hagadol suggests that it's a tzivui ledorot. It's a mitzvah for eternity. Long after the destruction of the temple and the loss of the menorah, Jews are still fulfilling the mitzvah of an eternal flame in synagogues and study halls. Because this mitzvah is the essence of the mission of the Jewish people forever. To be a light and to illuminate the world. So, God willing, Hashem should bless us to become as a people, you know, the vehicle for light that we're meant to be, and to create together a world of light and shalom, truly holy, all of us.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.